Our point of departure is indeed the subjectivity of the individual. And that for strictly philosophic reasons, it is not because we are bourgeois, but because we seek to base our teachings upon the truth and not upon a collection of fine theories. Full of hope, but lacking real foundations, and at the point of departure there cannot be any other truth than this. I think, therefore I am. Which is the absolute truth of consciousness as it attains to itself. Every theory which begins with man outside of this moment of self-attainment is a theory which thereby suppresses the truth. For outside of the Cartesian cogito, all objects are no more than probable, and any doctrine of possibilities which is not attached to a truth will crumble into nothing. In order to define the probable, one must possess the true. Before there can be any true whatever, then there must be an absolute truth. And there is such a truth which is simple, easily attained, and within the reach of everybody. It consists in one's immediate sense of one's self. In a second place, this theory alone is compatible with the dignity of man. It is the only one which does not make man into an object. All kinds of materialism lead one to treat every man, including oneself, as an object. That is, as a set of predetermined reactions, in no way different from the patterns of qualities and phenomena which constitute a table or a chair or a stone. Our aim is precisely to establish the human kingdom as a pattern of values in distinction from the material world. But the subjectivity which we thus postulate as the standard of truth is no narrowly individual subjectivism. For, as we have demonstrated, it is not only one's own self that one discovers in a cogito, but those of others too. Contrary to the philosophy of Descartes, contrary to that of Kant, when we say I think, we are attaining to ourselves in the presence of the other. And we are just as certain of the other as we are of ourselves. Thus the man who discovers himself directly in a cogito also discovers all the others, and discovers them as the condition of his own existence. He recognizes that he cannot be anything, in a sense in which one says one is spiritual or that one is wicked or jealous, unless others recognize him as such. I cannot obtain any truth whatsoever about myself, except through the mediation of another. The other is indispensable to my existence, and equally so to any knowledge I can have of myself. Under these conditions, the intimate discovery of myself is at the same time the revelation of the other as a freedom which confronts mine, and which cannot think or will without doing so either for or against me. Thus at once we find ourselves in a world which is, let us say, that of intersubjectivity. It is in this world that man has to decide what he is and what others are. Furthermore, although it's impossible to find in each and every man a universal essence that can be called human nature, there is nevertheless a human universality of condition. It is not by chance that the thinkers of the day are so much more ready to speak of the condition than of the nature of man. By his condition they understand with more or less clarity all the limitations which a priori define man's fundamental situation in the universe. His historical situations are variable. Man may be born a slave in a pagan society, or may be a feudal baron or a proletarian. But what never vary are the necessities of being in a world, of having to labor and to die there. These limitations are neither subjective nor objective, or rather there is both a subjective and an objective aspect to them. Objective because we meet with them everywhere and they are everywhere recognizable, and subjective because they are lived and are nothing if man does not live them. If that is to say, he does not freely determine himself and his existence in relations to them. And diverse though man's purpose may be, at least none of them is wholly foreign to me. Since every human purpose presents itself as an attempt either to surpass these limitations or to widen them, or else to deny or to accommodate oneself to them. Consequently, every purpose, however individual it may be, is of universal value. In this sense that every purpose is comprehensible to every man, not that this or that purpose defines man forever, but that it may be entertained again and again. There is always some way of understanding an idiot, a child, a primitive, man of a foreign, if one has sufficient information. In this sense, we may say that there is a human universality, but it is not something given. It is being perpetually made. I made this universality in choosing myself. I also make it by understanding the purpose of any other man of whatever epoch. This absoluteness of the act of choice does not alter the relativity of each epoch. What is at the very heart and center of existentialism is the absolute character of free commitment, by which every man realizes himself in realizing a type of humanity, a commitment always understandable to no matter whom, in no matter what epoch, and its bearing upon the relativity of the cultural pattern which may result in such absolute commitment. One must observe equally the relativity of Cartesianism and the absolute character of the Cartesian commitment. In this sense, you may say, if you like, that every one of us makes the absolute by breathing, by eating, by sleeping, or by behaving in any fashion whatsoever. There is no difference between free being, being as self-committal as existence choosing its essence, and absolute being. There is no difference whatever between being as an absolute temporarily localized, that is, localized in history, and universally intelligible being. This does not completely refute the charge of subjectivism. Indeed, that objection appears in several other forms, of which the first is as follows. People say to us that it does not matter what you do, and they say this in various ways. First, they tax us with anarchy. Then they say, you cannot judge others, or there is no reason for preferring one purpose to another. Finally, they may say, everything being merely voluntary in this choice of yours, you give away with one hand what you pretend to gain with the other. These three are not very serious objections. As to the first, to say that it does not matter what you choose is not correct. In one sense, choice is possible, but what is not possible is not to choose. I can always choose, but I must know that if I do not choose, that is still a choice. This, although it may appear merely formal, is of great importance as a limit to fantasy and caprice. For when I confront a real situation, for example that I am a sexual being able to have relationships with a being of the other sex and able to have children, I am obliged to choose my attitude to it. And in every respect, I bear the responsibility of the choice which, in committing myself, also commits the whole of humanity. Even if my choice is determined by no a priori value whatsoever, it can have nothing to do with caprice. And if anyone thinks that this is only Guide's theory of act gratuit over again, he has failed to see the enormous difference between this theory and that of Guide. Guide does not know what a situation is. His act is one of pure caprice. In our view, on the contrary, man finds himself in an organized situation in which he is himself involved. In his choice involves mankind in his entirety, and he cannot avoid choosing. Either he must remain single, or he must marry without having children, or he must marry and have children. In any case, and whichever he may choose, it is impossible for him, in respect of this situation, not to take complete responsibility. Doubtless, he chooses without reference to any pre-established value, but it is unjust to tax him with caprice. Rather, let us say that the moral choice is comparable to the constructions of a work of art. But here, I must at once digress to make it quite clear that we are not propounding an aesthetic morality, for our adversaries are disingenuous enough to reproach us even with that. I mention the work of art only by way of comparison, that being understood, does anyone reproach an artist? When he paints a picture for not following rules established a priori, does one ever ask what is the picture that he ought to paint? As everyone knows, there is no predefined picture for him to make. The artist applies himself to the composition of a picture, and a picture that ought to be made is precisely that which he will have made. As everyone knows, there are no aesthetic values a priori, but there are values which will appear in due course in the coherence of the picture, in the relations between the will to create and a finished work. No one can tell what the painting of tomorrow will be like. One can judge a painting until it's done. What has that to do with morality? We're in the same creative situation. We never speak of a work of art as irresponsible. When we are discussing a canvas by Picasso, we understand very well that the composition became what it is at the time when he was painting it, and that his work are part of parcel of his entire life. It is the same upon the plane of morality. There is this in common between art and morality, that in both we have to do with creation and invention. We cannot decide a priori what it is that should be done. I think it was made sufficiently clear to you in the case of that student who came to see me, that to whatever ethical system he might appeal, the Kantian or any other, he could find no sort of guidance whatever. He was obliged to invent the law for himself. Certainly, we cannot say that this man, in choosing to remain with his mother, that is, in taking sentiment, personal devotion, and concrete charity as his moral foundation, would be making an irresponsible choice. Nor could we do so if he preferred the sacrifice of going away to England. Man makes himself. He is not found ready-made. He makes himself by the choice of his morality, and he cannot but choose a morality such as the pressures of circumstances upon him. We define man only in relation to his commitments. It is therefore absurd to reproach us for irresponsibility in our choice. In the second place, people say to us, "You are unable to judge others." This is true in one sense and false in another. It is true in this sense that whenever a man chooses his purpose and his commitment in all clearness and in all sincerity, whatever that purpose may be, it is impossible for him to prefer another. It is true in the sense that we do not believe in progress. Progress implies amelioration, but man is always the same, facing a situation which is always changing, and choice remains always a choice in the situation. The moral problem has not changed since the time when it was a choice between slavery and anti-slavery. From the time when the War of Secession, for example, until the present moment, when one chooses between the MRP, Mouvement Républicain Populaire, and the Communist. We can judge, nevertheless, for as I have said, one chooses in view of others. And in view of others, one chooses himself. One can judge first, and perhaps this is not a judgment of value, but it is a logical judgment that in certain cases choice is founded upon error, and in others upon the truth. One can judge a man by saying that he deceives himself. Since we have defined the situation of man as one of free choice, without excuse and without help, any man who takes refuge behind the excuse of his passions or by inventing some deterministic doctrine is a self-deceiver. One may object, but why should he not choose to deceive himself? I reply that it is not for me to judge him morally, but I define his self-deception as an error. Here one cannot avoid pronouncing a judgment of truth. The self-deception is evidently a falsehood, because it is a dissimulation of man's complete liberty of commitment. Upon this same level, I say that it is also a self-deception if I choose to declare that certain values are incumbent upon me. I am in contradiction with myself. If I will these values, and at the same time say that they impose themselves upon me. If anyone says to me, "And what if I wish to deceive myself?" I answer, "There is no reason why you should not, but I declare that you are doing so, and that the attitude of strict consistency alone is that of good faith. Furthermore, I can pronounce a moral judgment, for I declare that freedom in respect of concrete circumstances can have no other end and aim but itself. And when once a man has seen that values depend upon himself, in that say of forsakenness, he can will only one thing, and that is freedom as the foundation of all values. That does not mean that he wills it in the abstract. It simply means that the actions of men of good faith have as their ultimate significance the quest of freedom itself as such. A man who belongs to some communist or revolutionary society wills certain concrete ends, which imply the will to freedom, but that freedom is willed in community. We will freedom for freedom's sake, in and through particular circumstances. And in thus willing freedom, we discover that it depends entirely upon the freedom of others, and that the freedom of others depends upon our own. Obviously, freedom as the definition of a man does not depend upon others, but as soon as there is a commitment, I am obliged to will the liberty of others at the same time as my own. I cannot make liberty my aim unless I make that of others equally my aim. Consequently, when I recognize as entirely authentic that man is a being whose existence precedes his essence, and that he is a free being who cannot, in any circumstance, but will his freedom, at the same time I realize that I cannot not will the freedom of others. Thus, in the name of that will to freedom which is implied in freedom itself, I can form judgments upon those who seek to hide from themselves the holy voluntary nature of their existence and its complete freedom. Those who hide from this total freedom in a guise of solemnity or with deterministic excuses, I shall call cowards. Others who try to show that their existence is necessary when it is merely an accident of the appearance of the human race on earth, I shall call scum. But neither cowards nor scum can be identified except upon the plane of strict authenticity. Thus, although the content of morality is variable, a certain form of this morality is universal. Kant declares that freedom is a will both to itself and to freedom of others. Agreed, but he thinks that the formal and the universal suffice for the constitution of morality. We think, on the contrary, that principles that are too abstract break down when we come to defining action. To take once again the case of that student, by what authority, in the name of what golden rule of morality, do you think he could have decided in perfect peace of mind either to abandon his mother or to remain with her? There are no means of judging. The content is always concrete and therefore unpredictable. It has always to be invented. The one thing that counts is to know whether the invention is made in the name of freedom. Let us, for example, examine the two following cases, and you will see how far they are similar in spite of the difference.